Donald Trump Jr. is rumored as an NRA leadership candidate. Plus, the NRA lags behind gun control groups in political fundraising. All this and more on the News Update. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the News Update. I'm contributing writer Jake Fogelman, joined as always by Reload founder Stephen Gutowski. How are we doing, Steve?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Doing well. Stephen, of course, is the founder of thereload.com, where you can head on over today and sign up for our free newsletter. This goes out once a week and keeps you up to date on all things happening in guns.
And we also have a sale going on right now, actually.
That's right.
Our third anniversary sale. If I could say it. Yeah. So if you head over and buy a membership today, you're going to get 20% off for the rest of the year or for your first year. And so, yeah, it's a pretty good deal. We don't do those very often. So take advantage while you can.
Yep. Listeners should definitely go check that out. But in the meantime, speaking of the newsletter, we're going to jump right into some of our stories this week. One of the big ones comes to us from you, actually, talking about some potential replacements for Wayne LaPierre to head up the NRA, and sort of an outside-the-box name came up as a potential replacement, if you want to tell us what your reporting found.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one NRA board member in an email to the rest of the board has suggested that Donald Trump Jr. would be interested in taking over, at least that he has expressed interest in the past and that he might reach out to him for the role that Wayne LaPierre has vacated. So it's a pretty significant possibility that could happen. This board member is somebody who is actually a pretty prominent Trump supporter in Pennsylvania. He actually just helped host a Trump rally there earlier this month, and he was involved in an effort to try and prove that the 2020 election was stolen. He's been sued by the forensics company that he hired and accused of trying to get them to fabricate evidence. Regardless, he is a very prominent Trump supporter and a member of the NRA board. So it's not coming from just sort of anyone saying this.
Right. Yeah. It's not like some Trump supporter on Twitter or something posited this. The fact that an actual board member is pitching this as a potential. Now, to be fair, it is just one board member at this point. So it's not like there's some big that at least that we're aware of. There's not some big behind the scenes push for this to happen. But it does represent sort of an interesting idea, because as we've covered, the NRA and sort of the Trump world, the Trump orbit have become, they're just so entwined at this point. Obviously, the NRA was one of Trump's biggest backers in 2016 financially, and was one of the earliest major groups to come out and endorse him. And they've stayed close even throughout the scandals that both of them have faced, quite frankly, in the ensuing years. So it's a little bit interesting that, you know, going from entwined to actually being one and the same would be a big step.
Yeah, it absolutely would really cement the influence that Trump has over the NRA, which is already very significant. The NRA has in recent years trended towards appealing almost exclusively to Trump voters, people in that demographic. There have been some efforts to highlight, different diverse groups that the NRA tries to appeal to or support, especially with some of the videos that they've made in recent months on different types of gun owners that they that are NRA members. But for the most part, they focus primarily on very conservative Republicans who tend to be major Trump supporters. And Trump has spoken at every one of their annual meetings since he first started running for president. And he also just spoke at their outdoor show in January up in Pennsylvania. And he also is likely to speak at the annual meeting coming up here next month in May. Although that's not, I don't know that that's confirmed yet. We'll see where that goes. But yeah, obviously making Trump Jr., his eldest son, the head of the NRA would be a pretty significant step in, you know, really cementing control over the organization from, well, one party's presidential candidate. You know, it's it'd be a fascinating thing to happen. Whether or not it actually does happen, I think, is another question. You know, this is a suggestion put forward by a board member. It's something that's certainly newsworthy. At the same time, you read the piece, I don't know that this is the direction that they're going to end up actually going. One, I'm not sure that Trump is as interested anymore, Trump Jr., in doing that. You know, this board member said that it was years ago that he suggested this sort of role where he would be like a national spokesperson for the NRA. And he suggested that he would reach out to Trump Jr. about filling the role that LaPierre has left. But when I asked the board member for comment, they didn't respond. Trump Jr.'s spokesperson didn't respond either. The NRA itself didn't respond. So it's hard to say where any of these guys stand. And obviously I have multiple sources inside of the NRA and former NRA staff or officials who put the odds for the next executive vice president, the next head of the NRA to be Charles Cotton, who's the current president, much higher than somebody like Trump Jr. or some of the other candidates that are out there running.
Certainly, yeah. It still seems, like you said, it's still early, one board member and not guaranteed to happen. But it is interesting in the fact that it's one name that's come up that's not someone that's already current leadership. That would be a break from the business as usual trajectory that many of people think they seem to be still be on, despite the court ruling finding that most of their current existing leadership was at least involved in some of the mismanagement of donors' funds. And,
yeah,
you know, there's certainly a contingent out there that would like to see a sort of a clean break and new fresh blood in the leadership. Now, whether or not Trump Jr. represents that for these people, yeah, is an open question, but at least it's someone from outside the organization, outside the old guard, taking the helm. But,
it would be, yeah, somebody, you know, it would be a big splashy thing to do, right? In terms of like, he's obviously a prominent person, especially within Republican politics and within the MAGA movement, right? You know, he's the son of Donald Trump, and he has been a prominent figure in that relationship between the NRA and Donald Trump as well, because he is an avid hunter and gun collector himself. He's very much involved in this issue. Like, it's something that he actually cares about. You know, that is unique. And it would, you know, it's interesting when you think about what would this do for the NRA if it actually happened. On the one hand, yeah, it would be, like I said, a big splashy thing. It'd probably get a lot of attention for them. It perhaps could bring back some of those people who left because they didn't like the corruption of LaPierre and the former leadership. And he's somebody who's new and wasn't technically involved in any official capacity before. Like I said, a lot of the core membership of the NRA likes Donald Trump. They're very much already extremely connected in the public eye, right? And so people who were previously giving to the NRA probably like Donald Trump a lot. Maybe that's changed a little bit since 2020. Maybe it hasn't, right? I mean, we've seen how his political fortunes have gone since January 6th or the pandemic or whatever else, and they haven't really changed that much even through everything. So you'd expect that a lot of those NRA members who were happy that the NRA was giving so much money to elect Trump in the first place, that they might, some of those may have been disillusioned and might come back if Trump Jr. were to be head. Now, I think that's a short-term thing, right? Because, you know, what it also does, obviously, is completely cements that connection between them and also diminishes their capacity to be like an independent advocacy organization. Because, you know, during the Trump presidency, as close as they were, there were times where they were critical of Donald Trump. Specifically when he suggested that he might support stricter gun laws in the wake of the Parkland shooting. And he infamously said, you know, that he supported taking the guns first and having due process second. The NRA did criticize him, however briefly, for that. And then they were able to convince him it wasn't the right path to take, I guess. They did have a lot of, you know, soft power during that era. They had, especially Chris Cox, the head of their lobbying arm, was closely connected to Donald Trump Jr. And Donald Trump himself. And Wayne LaPierre also had a personal connection with Donald Trump himself. Of course, both those guys are gone now, so there's a bit less of that personal connection left, and it's not clear how much Trump Jr. is still intertwined over there. But you know, it's harder to do any of that sort of criticism of the president if he's your father, right? And you're running. I mean, it just kind of makes the whole concept a bit of a joke. So, and then the long term, you're associated with somebody who is highly polarizing and very unpopular. So, you know, is that the right move in the long term? I don't know. That's where you'd have to criticize. Obviously, yeah, it might bring back some of those people who've left, but it also will probably permanently turn off a lot of other people who might otherwise be open to joining a gun rights organization. So,
yeah, I think that's a great point. It would be a temporary sugar high, perhaps, in the best case scenario. In the long term, you know, it's it would certainly be a far cry from the 90s and the 2000s when the NRA made a concerted effort to try to appeal to more than just one portion of the Republican Party. It was they endorsed Democrats, they endorsed Republicans, and it was just a matter of who they could develop relationships with on guns. And I think this, to your point, would kind of be the final nail in the coffin.
It would forestall any chance of going back to anything like that. Now, not, you know, the polarization of the country is not entirely due to the NRA pushing it in that direction. It was always more of a push-pull thing, but this would this would be a shove, right, for them. They're not going to be working with many Democrats if Donald Trump Jr. is their executive vice president or their national spokesperson or whatever. And so you also have to consider, too, like Donald Trump Jr.'s track record. Himself, like if you're ignoring the rest of the larger political stuff here, Donald Trump Jr. Was involved with the Trump Foundation. He was involved in that settlement that dissolved that New York charity. The attorney general, who is currently pursuing the case against the NRA, and just won a jury decision that the NRA had failed to safeguard its charitable assets, and Wayne LaPierre had is liable for millions of dollars that he took from the NRA. You know, that same AG also dissolved the Trump Foundation, which Trump Jr. had a role in. He was forced to pay back $10,000 to the foundation that was used to buy a portrait of his father. This was a big news story years ago. As people might remember, he had to take a class in charity governance, to ensure that he wouldn't make mistakes like that if he was ever on another charity again. Him and his siblings. But although that, as far as I'm aware, that doesn't actually forestall him from being on, being an officer in a charity again. So he could, I believe, serve as an officer of the NRA. But of course, he also has people might not remember this or have known that this happened, but he launched his own gun rights group back in 2022. It's called the Second Amendment Task Force, claims on its website, at least, to be a 501c4, which is the same thing as the membership section of the NRA is also a 501c4. But it didn't ever appear to actually do anything or have any operations. If you look at its website, the only person it lists on its team is Donald Trump Jr. as the chair of the group. There are no 990s available in the federal tax forms that you would file for a group like that. I asked Trump's representative for them if there were any, if he could provide them, and didn't receive a response. I haven't been able to find any evidence other than when it first launched, and which was in the period where Donald Trump Jr. had claimed he was responsible for blocking David Chipman's nomination to the ATF, which is I don't know that Donald Trump Jr. had much sway over people like Angus King, who actually or even Romney or Susan Collins or people of that nature who actually really blocked that nomination. But regardless, that's around the time that he formed this group. And outside of the one Fox story that talks about him launching it, I have not been able to find any other evidence that he did anything. If you look at its donation page, it's not active anymore, so you can't donate to it. It's not clear if the group is still active or what's going on with it, but not exactly an inspiring track record if you're looking for somebody to run the day-to-day operations of the NRA or what have you.
Yeah, I was going to say, not exactly a good resume to take the top job in the largest gun rights organization in the country that, you know, despite its flaws and its current struggles with certain operations, is still doing quite a bit of work in this space.
It's still a several hundred million dollar organization. Now, to be fair, the suggestion from that email was that he would be more of a spokesperson, national spokesperson, wouldn't be involved in the day-to-day running of the organization, like Wayne LaPierre had been. But, we'll see. The other piece of news that was in that story, though, is that they actually are now going to have a search committee meeting, in Atlanta, Georgia, for some reason, where board members, NRA board members, are invited to attend, but they won't be, the NRA won't pay for them to go to this meeting. So they'd have to pay their own way there. It's not clear if it's open to NRA members for whatever reason, or to the press. I asked the NRA, but they didn't respond, of course. So, that's happening in Atlanta at, it's at like a hotel, an airport hotel. If I can find the details here. Yeah, the Embassy Suites by the Hilton Atlanta Airport Hotel. The meeting's going to be at 9 a.m. on Saturday, April 27th. So I don't know if NRA members are welcome at this thing or what. They've done this in the past with some board meetings during the pandemic where they just, when they canceled the annual meeting, and I believe it was 2021, they held the board meeting just in a totally different city than where the annual meeting was going to be and didn't really publicize that it was going to happen. It's a similar situation here, I think. And everything I've heard from my sources inside the organization or former officials point to, instead of Trump Jr. or somebody like that being nominated to take the permanent role of executive vice president, it's probably going to be current President Charles Cotton. That seems to be the trajectory things are going. It's not 100%, obviously. And I don't really know where the most of the board is at these days. I haven't been making much noise outside of exchanging emails among each other. But that's perhaps what's going to come out of this meeting on Saturday. But we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yep, we'll certainly stay on top of it. But keeping in line with the NRA, we have also some more news about the NRA this week and sort of the ongoing struggles they've had and some of the changes in their operations and their capabilities in light of some of the recent scandals and some of the uncertainty at leadership, because we have some new FEC numbers. So Federal Election Commission publishes, or PACs, so the political arms of these groups, have to file reports every month showing how much money they raised. This week we published a story about the fact that the NRA, its primary political arm, its PAC, the Political Victory Fund, raised about $660,000 for the month of March, just shy of $660,000. But the three major gun control groups, their counterparts, Giffords and Everytown and Brady, put together, raised about $880,000. So 2 months in a row now that we've done stories where the NRA has been outraised by its political opponents, which didn't used to happen, if listeners recall.
No, yeah, it's a pretty rare thing. The NRA has dominated political fundraising in the gun space for decades now, I would say. And certainly, since the 2000s through the 2020s, the early 2020s. And so it's fairly significant that they're now continually being outraised each month by these gun control groups. And not because the gun control groups are necessarily doing much better than they have traditionally. It's almost entirely because the NRA is doing much worse than it has traditionally. I mean, you have comparisons to the two previous presidential election cycles, right?
I was going to say, yeah, just to provide some context on that. So $660,000 this March 2024. In March 2020, it was about $1.1 million. And then in March 2016, it was, let's see, I just had it. It's $1.4 million. So yeah, substantially down from previous presidential elections.
Like a huge drop off. And they, you know, they have about $12 million cash on hand right now, but that's primarily because they also haven't been spending any money, right?
That's right. So they just spent like around $100,000 in March 2024 compared to the gun control groups that spent about $2 million.
That's through the whole
put together.
The whole
put
year.
Together.
Right?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Year to date, first quarter of 2024.
So they've only spent $100,000 so far.
Now, in a major election year.
Yeah. Now obviously, it's still very early in sure. the election season. So the bulk of your spending is going to come later on. And the NRA does right now have a pretty significant cash on hand advantage over those gun control groups, right? Because they have about $12 million.
Yeah, 12 and a half million, something like that. And all the three groups put together only have about 10. So they have the cash on hand advantage for sure.
So they still, you know, they're not, none of this is to say that they're going to be completely ineffective or you're useless in this election. It's just, the trend is looking bad for them. You know, they spent upwards of $50 million in 2016 to help Trump get elected. This is part of, going back to the previous story, part of why they have such a close relationship with him, because he really seems to value them, because they were one of the first groups, as you mentioned, to back him. And they put a lot of money into his election, which most people didn't think was going to work. Right. I mean, right. Everybody thought he was going to lose that election. Except for perhaps the NRA, and they turned out to be right. And that seems to have stuck with Trump all this time. But so they're still going to be around, but they're not going to get anywhere near $50 million. And I don't think they're going to get near what they did in 2020 either, which was about $20 million. Right. So a huge decline from 2016, but still probably, I mean, they'd be lucky if they get 17, 16 million. You know, at this point, they've got about $12 million. They're raising, you know, I think over the last 2 months, they've raised about $1 million. So it's about $500,000 a month. Now, I think they are accelerating a bit. So we'll see what they do next month. But I don't know. There's not a lot of money there compared to where they, you know, previously. Now, it's still way more money, to be fair. And this is another important point that we try to make all the time. This is still way more than all the other gun rights groups combined. Right. You know, if you add them all up, the other gun rights groups have raised, I think it was something around $200,000.
Yeah, $180,000, almost exactly, $180,000.
Okay. So they, you know, that puts them closer to that, filling that gap with the gun control groups combined, but not quite. You know, they're still, even with the other groups out there, and we're talking about everybody you could think of, right? The Gun Owners of America, I mean, they don't really do much in this space. They raise about $500, but you know, the National Shooting Sports Foundation has two different PACs, that they're a PAC and a super PAC, and the NRA has a super PAC as well, but it hasn't been raising its own money. Usually they transfer money from the PAC to the super PAC so that they can have flexibility in how they spend that money. But, it raised what, $20,000 or something like that?
About, yeah, 25. Yeah.
And then you have what, USCCA has a PAC. You've got, What were some of the other gun rights PACs?
National Association of Gun Rights has a PAC that wasn't doing much originally, but then all of a sudden last month raised about $90,000. So not nothing, but okay. Certainly not the same as the NRA.
But yeah, again, you look at any of these other groups and nobody is filling this vacuum that the NRA is leaving behind. Not even close, right? I mean, like you said, it was $1.4 million in 2016, $1.1 in 2020, and now with the other gun rights groups combined into their total, it's about 800,000, not 800 million. Good Lord. So, you know, you get the point. It's the NRA is still the largest, still extremely relevant, but they're slipping, they're shrinking. And that's there's bad news here overall for the gun rights movement, is what I would say.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case, especially heading into a presidential election where, as we've pointed out several times, you have, you know, Donald Trump is sort of the imperfect avatar of the gun rights side, but he's running against a president in Joe Biden who has prioritized gun control mm-hmm. more vocally than perhaps, you know, the last, at least for the last couple of decades, more than any other president. So you think Trump, that the gun rights.
Trump is facing a money squeeze himself, too, just like back in 2016. Though for different reasons, you know, he didn't get a lot of support back in 2016 from you know, the Republican apparatus, not nearly as much as he did in 2020 or 20 or now. But a lot of Trump's money is being very similar to what's going on with the NRA is being siphoned off for his legal troubles, for all of his legal expenses. The NRA is having the exact same problem. That's among their top expenses are legal costs. These bills that they're paying to Bill Brewer and his firm for the myriad of trials that they've got themselves into over the last several years. And so Trump really needs monetary support, and the NRA in 2016 was there to provide it, but it surely doesn't look like they're going to be able to do that again this time around.
Yeah, I think it's probably right. But as we have in past elections, we'll of course keep on top of following the spending and the fundraising as we get closer to election day in November.
Yeah.
But one of the last stories we want to talk about from our side of the newsletter is actually a guest post from gun rights lawyer Costas Moros. He's written for us a few times in the past. And this week he has a good piece in our newsletter about he took a look at a brief filed by the state of Illinois in the request for Supreme Court review on the state's assault weapon ban. Their case, obviously, the ban rather, has been upheld at both the federal court level and the federal appellate court level. And gun rights advocates are hoping that they can finally get the Supreme Court's attention on an assault weapon ban case. And Costas makes the case that the way Illinois argued in its brief and the way that the ruling was decided at the Seventh Circuit should catch the Supreme Court's attention. He makes an interesting case there. And there's also some question as to whether or not that will be the case, just because we haven't seen we haven't seen a lot of appetite from the Supreme Court as of yet for a hardware ban. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, you know, I asked Costas to write this piece because he was pointing out some of the more adventurous, I guess, defenses that you might call them that Illinois was putting up for its, AR-15 ban, essentially. And, I thought he made a pretty decent case as to why they might, trip up the Supreme Court. There's essentially this idea that these guns don't qualify as arms under the Second Amendment. Really kind of flies in the face of everything the Supreme Court has said on this topic to this point. It reminds me a bit of that Hawaii case, the Spirit of Aloha case, where they just basically flat out reject the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on the Second Amendment and say it doesn't matter at all. This is a similar idea here where they're just trying to say AR-15s aren't even arms, which goes directly against how the Supreme Court has interpreted what arms are. It just seems like they're really pushing the boundaries. You know, they're not, you've reviewed a bunch of these cases and written some analysis pieces for us on these hardware bans and how they've been upheld in the lower courts under Bruin, and where they've tried to focus on something plausible. You know, you can obviously people will argue over the merits of these rulings and the arguments in them. But this concept that, you know, technology has changed and therefore we have to reason through analogy so we can take a bit of a broader view, and we can point to some of these gun restrictions that existed at the founding and say, well, they had some vague similarity to what they were trying to do as this magazine ban does or whatever. And that's at least in the Bruin framework. But this argument in particular, I think, tries to sidestep the whole thing and say, well, one, as Costas gets at, the whole thing that the Supreme Court was really raging against in Bruin and spends quite a bit of time doing. So it was this idea of a two-step test that Heller had created, this two-step test. And they explicitly said, there's no two-step test. It's a one-step test. And this concept of trying to do a whole test on whether or not a gun falls under arms, the definition of arms, it was not something that the Supreme Court had in mind. They had a pretty broad view of what an arm is, given the legal definitions from the founding era. And so, you know, that's where this seems much more, I don't know, ripe for a review if the Supreme Court wants to. You know, it just feels like they're tempting fate by making some of these arguments, which is more or less what Kostas is saying in this piece. And I think it's a good analysis piece. I do, and even he, towards the end of the piece, admits like doesn't necessarily mean the court's actually going to take it up. Right. That's the thing. Like, this court does not seem super eager to take up hardware ban cases at this point. They've had a lot of opportunities to intervene early on, and they don't appear to have the appetite for it. And I don't know that that's going to happen here, because this is still a case that's at the preliminary injunction phase, which is fairly early on in the process. So it's not a merits case yet. There may be some merits cases that are closer to being ready for the court to take, but I don't know. I just found some of these arguments that Illinois was willing to put into their brief feel like the kind of thing that's just Justice Thomas or somebody is going to be pretty triggered by, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Listeners should go definitely read the piece for themselves to see what we're talking about, because I think Adventurous is right, especially for the argument that rifles are not arms somehow. Yeah. I think that's an interesting novel approach. But to your point, there's not been much indication yet that the Supreme Court is looking for a hardware ban case. They seem to more have their hands full with one, more regulatory gun related stuff, all the, the ATF regulations, and then more cleaning up the implications of their Bruin test when it comes to prohibited possessors. That seems to be also what's taken the most attention. So we'll see, of course. You never know. Maybe we'll get a surprise cert grant, but if that's the case, you can come follow the reload and we'll report all about it. But
that is what every gun rights activist in the country seems to want. So, I think that's what everybody expected was going to happen after Bruin, but, real life got in the way, I guess, because when you shake up all of gun jurisprudence, it's probably going to lead somewhere first that you're not necessarily expecting. And that's what we've seen with all these prohibited persons cases they've got Rahimi. They still haven't released that yet, but they'll probably take range after Rahimi. I wouldn't be surprised. So we'll see.
Yep. That seems to be where their attention will be for the foreseeable future. As we're getting closer to time here, before we go, we want to hit a couple quick hits from our Outside the Reload section of the newsletter. Couple interesting stories this week. One of them comes to us from North Carolina Newsline, and it's all about the fact that gun rights advocates this year are making a concerted push to make North Carolina the 30th permitless carry state. It's, listeners may be familiar. We've talked about this several times now. North Carolina really, at least as politics currently sits, is really the only gettable state remaining for gun rights advocates. And, they've had this remarkable success in getting permitless carry all across the country in the last couple decades. And North Carolina is really where, in terms of the balance of power of the state, is the last potential pickup. So it's interesting to see that they're taking that to heart and they're circulating petitions and trying to lobby lawmakers in the Republican supermajority that exists there. So we'll have to see if this year a 30th permitless carry state comes.
Do they have a Democratic governor there?
They still have a Democratic governor. Okay. Listeners may recall that big success for the gun rights movement last year was a pistol permit purchase repeal, where they actually had to override his veto to get that across the line. So that's the big hang up.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a Democratic governor who doesn't seem favorable to these things, but they have a supermajority to override his veto if they can stick together. But we saw this in Louisiana, right? A couple of year or two ago where they, it was a similar situation, but and they passed permitless carry, but the governor vetoed it, and then the Republican coalition fell apart on the veto override. So It's definitely much harder to do, and even in that sort of political makeup. And, you know, the election for governor there is actually, I believe, is in, it's an NRA board member who's running, but he's somebody who's made a lot of controversial statements and seems to be polling really poorly in the general election. So, you know, I don't know. We'll see how that shakes out, but they might end up in the same spot next year, or who knows, maybe they'll lose seats. North Carolina seems fairly competitive this year. Like it's trending slightly more competitive over time, but I don't know. Yeah, they've got that supermajority right now, and maybe they'll be able to get it through.
I was gonna say, I think that seems to be the concern, is that one, they might not pick up the governorship, and then because of the polarizing nature of the candidate that the Republicans have chosen there, they may end up costing them some seats in the supermajority. So I think that's why they think it's crunch time this year. But we'll of course stay on top of it to see how that goes. And then the last two stories are kind of related. One of them comes to us from the Center Square. The other one comes to us from Bearing Arms. And it's about two separate states now that this week signed bills to ban merchant category codes, which are the sort of half-baked, I don't want to be unfair, but half-baked idea that that credit card companies can track suspicious gun purchases, and it sort of picked up steam among gun control advocates, and a couple of blue states have passed their laws mandating them. Yeah. And you've seen this sort of counter reaction in red states now, where I think we're at 13, 14 states now that have laws on the books banning the use of these codes. And so this week, Tennessee and Iowa became the latest too.
Yeah. So this goes back to that whole polarization of gun policy at the state level thing, where you're just going to have wildly contrasting state policies on guns from here on out, even more so than we previously had. And the MCC code is a pretty wild version of that, because you're going to have like blue states where it's required for them to have this code, which doesn't do what advocates think it does. And you're going to have red states that ban it, where advocates, where again, like the code doesn't actually do what people think it, like it's just the base level concept of why there should be a special code for gun retailers isn't workable, at least not at this stage. And everyone is going to pass laws on it regardless, though. So it's interesting. I mean, that's the trend right now, especially on the right, is these privacy acts. But I mean, honestly, I don't think they don't harm anything. That's for sure. It's just like, you can't have this MCC code, which are primarily used by credit card companies to like give you promotion. That's how like airline mile credit cards work and stuff like that. There's your credit card gives you certain cash back for certain kinds of purchases. That's how they determine that stuff. But they don't know what you're actually buying at those things. They don't have access to look at the cart level view. But anyway, we've talked about that a lot in the past. It's interesting to see this take up so much steam already, though.
I'll say it is indicative of the trend where blue state passes something, red states react with something that was never going to happen in their state anyway, but they still say it's banned, you can't do it. And that sort of becomes the latest trend in gun politics at the state level, at least. But that's all we got for the news stuff. You got anything going on this weekend as we head into the weekend here?
I think the Sixers are playing again, right? The NBA playoffs are going on. I mean, you've got two teams, right, in Colorado.
I was going to say, I got my hands full. Yeah. Been pretty happy with the playoffs so far. The Avs looked terrible in their game one, but they won game two. And then the Nuggets look like they're going to sweep the Lakers again, which always makes me happy to see us beat up on the Lakers. So that's so been pretty good.
Yeah, the Sixers won last night. They got totally screwed out of the previous game. The NBA has this weird thing, I guess, where they like come out and admit when your team got screwed. I mean, they fell apart. So, you know, they shouldn't have been able to. Like the end of that game two was nuts. But also the NBA was like, oh yeah, there were like two uncalled fouls and they didn't give a timeout they were supposed to. And it's like any of those things would have made it so that the Sixers would have won that game. But it's weird to come out and say like, yeah, but it's like, oh, thanks, I guess. Yeah. Thanks for admitting that. They don't reverse the outcome of the game, though. So,
right.
Cool. But yeah, we'll see. I guess Embiid has Bell's palsy right now. Which probably sounds much scarier. I actually had Bell's palsy at one point, which is just like a nerve issue in your face that makes your like face droop a little bit, or it makes you, for me, it like, I couldn't smile on my left side or whatever, but it, like, it sounds like cerebral palsy or something, like sounds serious, but it's not, it's like an inflammation of like a nerve in your face. But still, like, he's, I feel bad for the guy. It's just always something that he has to deal with once they get to the playoffs.
I was gonna say, not ideal in the playoffs, whatever it is. Yeah.
I don't think it, I don't know if it can really affect your, like, physically, like how you play basketball. I don't know. It might make you look a little weird.
Yeah.
Because you can't, like, move some of the muscles in your face, but, or at least not fully. Like, I couldn't, it would make it so that, like, my left side wouldn't be able to smile or whatever. Couldn't move some of those muscles, but it goes away after, you know, if you get treatment for it, you're fine. But just a weird and unfortunate happenstance for our big man. And then the draft was last night, the NFL draft. The Eagles, the best cornerback in the draft fell to them. There's all this noise about how they were going to trade up, and then they just didn't have to because everybody drafted quarterbacks. Including your Broncos, right?
That's right. Yeah, we picked up the last of the considered top tier quarterbacks, Bo Nix from Oregon. So now the Broncos have the dubious distinction of having a quarterback room that consists of the rookie Bo Nix, Zach Wilson from the Jets, and Jarrett Stidham. So it's fierce competition for an elite quarterback in Denver with about $80 million in dead cap space as well. So we can't really give them a lot of weapons.
From Ross, yeah. Oh my gosh.
So things are real, real good in Broncos country.
Yeah. Let's ride.
That's right. Let's ride to last place.
Yeah. And then hopefully, you know, I don't know, hopefully I watched some Phillies. Harper came back and from paternity leave, he has like third kid, and immediately every time he's come back from paternity leave, he hits a home run. So, you know, at first I was like, he needs to stop having kids because he's got to take time off from the season to, you know, be with his family, which, gosh, what a selfish guy. But, but then every time he comes back from paternity leave, he hits home runs. So it's like, maybe he should have more kids.
Yep.
So that, you know, every couple weeks he's hitting these home runs. You know, I don't know. He's a fascinating guy. He shows up in the big, like when something is happening, he's always there to make it interesting. But they're doing great. They split with the Reds. I don't know. Well, I'm pretty happy with them so far. So looking forward to baseball, they play like every day. So I'm sure they have games coming up. And then hopefully I can play some board games, Terraforming Mars, maybe this weekend with friends. I don't know. Well, I honestly, if that's my, when I have time off, that's mostly what I do is like board game with my friends. Maybe I'll get to the range and try to sight in my optic for my carry gun to 20 yards. I would like to do. That's what the optic tells me I should do. It feels excessive, but they're like, oh yeah, if you sight it at this range, it'll be accurate at, you know, along the course, you know, it'll be a lot more accurate out to whatever distance. I'm not planning to shoot anyone with my concealed carry gun from 20 yards. So I think that'd be hard to explain in court, but you know, regardless, if this gets me a better zero at 3 to 5 yards, then I'm happier with that, or 7 yards or what have you. So I should do that. Right. I should. So we'll see if I do. But yeah, that's all we've got for this week. Make sure you head over and take advantage of that sale I mentioned at the top of the show. 20% off your first year. That's pretty good. And we don't do it very often. So head over to reload.com. Check out our membership options today. You can, of course, appear on this podcast. Well, you'll be on the interview podcast, which, by the way, this week we've got Jonathan Adler. And we're talking about the Supreme Court's new ghost gun case. So that's going to be a good episode. That'll be out for members on Sunday and everyone else on Monday. So another membership perk, you know, it'll be in your Sunday newsletter that you get for being a member. And of course, you'll get access to hundreds of pieces of analysis and stories that you will not find anywhere else. But that's all we've got for you. We will see you guys again real soon.